Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the fluoride deception right after this. You know, during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and that helped to provide their own food and food fiber for themselves and for their country. But today, over half of our food that we eat is imported from outside of our borders. Our food is produced from hybrid seed that will no longer reproduce and is nutritionally deficient. Now, Adolf Steinbrum of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter into perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to commercial feeds. When compared to more than 4,000 samples of this hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Steinbrum's open pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, and 205% more manganese, and the same result was also seen with the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. And in the opinion of many eco-farmers, or ecologic farmers, these hybrid seeds merely mask poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being in the first place. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of fluoride and General Leslie Groves' problem. The problem was with the toxic nature of the fluoride. I mean, this stuff is toxic stuff. And so they had to figure out a way that they could keep it secret from the Germans. They didn't want the Germans to know how much we had and where we were getting it and what we were doing with it. And so that was top secret. They were building this atomic bomb, and they had to keep the uranium and the nuclear project secret. And they got this terrible toxic stuff, and it's killing people, but it's only killing a few. I mean, we're only talking about a few hundred people here killed during World War II from the fluoride. And, you know, just if you stop and think about the number of people killed at Nagasaki and Hiroshima, you know, by the tens of thousands. The few people who were killed in the development of the bomb over here are just kind of a footnote in the whole thing. But the point of the book is to show you that this stuff was highly toxic. They knew that it was highly toxic. They wanted to use it for chemical warfare. They knew it was a neurological agent. They'd experimented on a whole city of people, giving them low doses of it during World War II. They discovered that it didn't seem to have any ill effects when fed in low dosages in the water supply. So that's where your fluoride got started. It was an experiment on a live population of people. I think it was Utica, New York. I'm not positive about that. It mentions it here in the book. And they discovered that it didn't kill these people. Now, had it killed those people, they would have just been, well, it's done in the name of national defense and security and science. I guess that's the excuse that they would have used. Joe Stalin, remember, said that when one guy dies, it's a tragedy. But when a million people die, it's a statistic. Now, this thing of fluoride in your water supply over here isn't a total loss. There was a lady called me one time years ago from Cortez, Colorado. It's back in the early 80s. And she said, you know, they're having city council meetings here, and they're going to put fluoride in our water. I didn't think much about it because, you know, by that time, you know, most towns had fluoride in the water, very common. And in fact, at that time, I didn't know there was a great problem with it. But she was concerned about fluoride in the water, and so she asked me what kind of legal steps she could take to prevent it. And I said, well, I don't know of any. I don't think that you're going to stop fluoride in the water supply. And why would you want to? That was kind of my question, you know. What's the point? What's that's like trying to get chlorine out of your water. What's the problem with it? And then she evidently had done some research and done some reading and came to the conclusion that fluoride probably wasn't all that great stuff. And so she said, well, how would I find out how the courts are going to rule on this? And I said, well, we do a legal research and find out, or a legal search and find out. So she commissioned me to do that. So I went down to the law library there in Boise, Idaho, and we sat down with the Lexus operator, and I said, well, let's look up fluoride, how many times have the courts ruled on it, and one thing and another. And so we went up to the top. We went to the Supreme Court reports and found there were 17 fluoride cases as of 1983, 17 cases. 9 and 8 were the way they divided out, 9 winning cases and 8 losing cases. I was amazed. I would have said there'd be 17, if there were 17 cases, they'd all be 17 losers. I mean, you're not going to fight fluoride. That's like fighting the IRS and income tax and Federal Reserve. And so the upshot of it was I gave her the information. Well, it come to find out in Colorado there was a statute on the books enacted by their legislature which prohibits the introduction of a toxic substance into the water supply in the cities and villages and the towns of Colorado. So you Coloradans can defeat that pretty easy. I don't know if that's true in every state, but it's true in Colorado. So she went down to city council meeting and she said, if you want to put fluoride in the water, don't put it in mine. And so, of course, he said, well, if we're going to put it in the water, it's going to be in everybody's water. And she said, well, I don't have any cause of action, you know, as long as you're talking down here. But she cited the statute and she said, now this fluoride is a toxic waste substance. It comes from the nuclear industry, the fertilizer industry, and the aluminum industry. And I don't want it in my water. It's a highly toxic chemical that kills. And it's prohibited by state statute. And the first day that fluoride comes out of my faucet, rest assured, litigation will surely result. And so they got to talking that over among themselves, and they decided that they didn't want fluoride in Cortez, Colorado. Now, I don't know if you got it now or not, but at least as of 1983, just one person went down to the meeting and said, don't put it in my water. And she prevailed, and that was the end of that. Now, you could probably do that in your town. I don't know if you can get it removed. I don't see any cases where once fluoride is introduced where it's been removed, but I don't see why you can't remove it under the same statute. Probably going to take some litigation in that case, you know, because they're not going to take it out by threat, but they won't put it in under that kind of a threat. So there's a little story for you on the positive side, you know, if you want to do something about it. I'm a little more passive. I'm not really concerned about trying to prevent all the rest of the people from putting fluoride in their water. I just don't want the fluoride in my water, so that's why I have my own water, my own water company. It's the Gordon Water Company. And so I produce my own water, and my water is free of of contaminants, and I got good, clean, pure water. And I recommend it highly, you know, to anybody that's looking for water. And then when I go somewhere, I take my water with me. You know, I load up my car and we take gallons and gallons of water when I'm going to be gone for a week or two. And if I'm gone for too long, well, then I start buying bottled water. Now, I hate to buy bottled water, you know, and pay $9 a gallon for it, but if I have to, I do. I get a little fluoride just like everybody else, but I try to limit it. I keep it as low as possible. the moral to the story, it's a cumulative poison, and it builds up over time. And so the longer you're drinking it, the more of it builds up in your body until finally your body can't handle it anymore and you'll come down with some kind of a symptom and you'll probably die from something other than fluoride poisoning, but it'll be the fluoride that is the triggering cause of it. How many people are being killed every year from it? Well, we don't know. There's no definitive number out here, but it's in the thousands. I don't think it's in, it may be a few ten thousands. It won't be in the millions, of course, but it'll be, you know, many, many thousands of people now, cumulatively over time, are dying from other diseases and other symptoms that are triggered by this cumulative toxic poison called fluoride. So tuck that one away in your heart. Now, General Groves had a solution, needed a solution, and he came up with a solution to his problem. And the guy's name was Dr. Harold Hodge. Remember the guy that we saw here in Chapter 1, 2, and 3, who kept the wartime secret to his grave. I don't think he ever divulged any of those wartime secrets, took his mission seriously. Now, from his corner office window in the medical school at Strong Memorial Hospital that summer in 1943, Dr. Harold Hodge could see construction workers placing the finishing touches on a $500,000 building at the University of Rochester, known as the Manhattan Annex. The heavily guarded structure, funded by the U.S. Army, would be home to the Manhattan Project's medical section. Orders had been placed for hundreds of experimental animals, Puerto Rican monkeys, dogs, mice, rabbits, and guinea pigs, and an umbilical cord-like tunnel linking the military annex with the university hospital was urgently being readied. As the new annex foundations were put down, so too was the keystone laid for the post-war practice of toxicology in the United States, and for the future career of the 39-year-old biochemist Dr. Harold Hodge. The annex would soon house the largest medical laboratory in the nation, with a staff of several hundred scientists testing the toxicity of the chemicals being used to build the atomic bomb. I'm going to pause here and make an observation. Now, remember, the first public information that we had that fluoride was a neurotoxin was done by this Phyllis Mullinex. And remember, she was working at the Forsyth Dental Research Laboratory, and this Harold Hodge, who's now an old man, you know, by the time this is done in 1980s and 90s, was right there with her. And he never let on that he knew about this toxic reaction that people get from this fluoride over here. But now remember, we're reading the story back from the Manhattan Project secret documents that are finally released after this lady has been fired from her job. Hodge took this secret to his grave. But he knew about it because he's the one that was the overseer of the project back in January of 1943. Now, military pilots flew the exotic new compounds directly from the bomb factories to Hodge's team at Rochester, New York. So Harold would actually meet the pilots under cover of dark to get the material to test, said toxicologist Judith McGregor, who befriended Hodge at Rochester, where she was a graduate student in the 1960s and who was mesmerized by her mentor's tales. It was unbelievable, she said. Now, that spring of 1943, Hodge had been placed in charge of the Bomb Program's Division of Pharmacology and Toxicology and given control of a secret biomedical research unit known as Program F to study fluoride toxicity. The Manhattan Project had a whole section working on uranium and a whole section working on fluoride, explained Jack Hine, who worked with Hodge at Rochester during the early Cold War as a young graduate student and remembers the scale of the fluoride studies. These toxicology studies were very comprehensive. They were looking for toxic effects on the bone, the blood, and the nervous system. Without the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb, we wouldn't know anywhere near as much as we do about the physiological effects of fluoride, Hine added. His research suddenly blossomed into an immense program. Noted Paul Morrow, he's a uranium expert who also joined the Hodge at Rochester in 1947 and who worked on some of the earliest experiments. Hodge's war work germinated into a career as the nation's leading expert on fluoride. Over more than half a century, the tall, black-haired researcher published several books and some 300 scientific papers. He was chairman of the National Research Council's Committee on Toxicology. He was the first president of the Society of Toxicology, and a generation of Hodge's Rochester colleagues and students, men such as Herbert Stokinger, Paul Morrow, and Helmuth Schrenk, went on to occupy leading positions in government agencies and universities after the war. And he was arguably the dean of American toxicology, stated a former colleague and Rochester alumni, Ernest Neubrunn, now a professor emeritus at the University of California at San Francisco. To several generations of colleagues, the soft-spoken scientist with the slicked black back hair was a gentleman scholar, tutor, advising them to play it straight, and regularly in his early 70s, trouncing graduate students at squash. But Harold Hodge, grandfather, soft-spoken friend, dean of the American Toxicology, shouldered dark secrets for most of his professional life. That summer of 1943, as Dr. Hodge stood at his office window, he confronted a terrible dilemma. Speed was essential in beating the Germans to full-scale production of the atomic bomb. The fate of tens of thousands of American workers lay in his hands. His laboratory's evaluation of the toxicity of chemicals needed for the bomb, such as fluoride, fluorine, beryllium, and others, would fix work conditions for the women and men inside the Manhattan Project's bomb factories, help determine how quickly the plants could achieve full production, and whether employers would be successfully sued for damages if those workers claimed injury from chemical exposure. So the questions were many, and the answers were few, wrote Hodge. And there was no time to wait for months or even weeks while the accepted laboratory tests established the toxicological facts. Production had to proceed with no delays. So people working in the atomic energy production plants were going to be chronically exposed, said Jack Hine. We all knew that. And we didn't know too much about the toxicity of fluoride other than the early studies saying a little too much in the water causes damage to teeth, he added. Well, General Leslie Groves understood the dangers of such pell-mell production, and he feared the personal injury lawsuits that would be an Achilles heel for the entire nuclear program, leading to millions and billions of dollars in claims. Leading insurers such as Aetna and Travelers were providing health coverage for workers in the new bomb factories. Successful claims for fluoride injury or for neighborhood pollution might hemorrhage compensation payments, create a public relations disaster, risk jeopardizing the embryonic nuclear industry, and threaten the United States' unprecedented new military power. And the Army moved quickly to protect itself. Its first weapon was secret. And the first weapon in the arsenal was secrecy. The second weapon was seizing control of basic science. In particular, the crucial toxicity studies on bomb program chemicals performed at the University of Rochester were sculpted and shaped to defend the Manhattan Project from lawsuits. Those marching orders, conscripting science and law for military service, were drummed home in a July 30th, 1945 memorandum, which was titled Purpose and Limitations of the Biological and Health Physics Research Program, written by the head of the medical section, Colonel Stafford Warren. And according to Warren, the Manhattan District, as a unit of the U.S. Army, has been given a directive to conduct certain operations which will be useful in winning the war. As such, medico-legal experts and aspects were accorded a clear priority for scientists and added, including the necessary biological research to strengthen the government's interests. Let's pause here and let's analyze it. Can you imagine today what would happen if the truth about fluoride were ever made public, I mean, at this late date, it would bankrupt the nation. It would bankrupt the insurance industry. There is no way in hell that anybody is ever going to admit the toxicity of fluoride has killed tens of thousands of people over the last 50 years. Can you imagine the number of lawsuits against dentists, the American Dental Association, for having known this for this many years and kept it secret? I mean, we're talking about billions and billions and hundreds of billions of dollars in lawsuits. And so one of the first rules that we follow in law is keep your mouth shut. Second rule, deny everything. That's the first thing that we do. You shut up and then deny it all. We didn't do that. And that's because the law requires that you prove your case. Now, the case against fluoride can be proven. So the trick is you've got to keep this out of the courts. You have to keep a propaganda campaign up, and you got to keep your best foot forward. I don't know when this thing is ever gonna hit the ceiling, and it may. If it does, God help us all. Now, for you and I down here at the bottom of the barrel, our problem is how do we survive this? How do we stop these guys from poisoning us? It almost gets to the point where I've said about President Johnson, I mean, he got to lying so much about the Vietnam War that I think he began to believe his own spin and his own press reports. And it could well be that George Bush is actually believing his own press reports today. You know, you got to ask yourself, now, how does somebody stand up here, keep a straight face, and then keep telling all these lies? And the lies concerning fluoride over here are lies on top of lies on top of lies. There are books and books and books written by people that know their onions, just like this guy here, Bryson, you know, who's got the documentation here, can tell you where the bodies are buried, how toxic this stuff is. You know, it's a perfect crime because you're poisoning whole water supplies. Multiple millions of people are on both sides of the issue. I mean, you've got people out here, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife and plumbers and carpenters. They'll just swear by fluoride and tell you anybody that would say something bad about fluoride's got his head up the wrong end. And then the truth of the matter is that a plumber doesn't know anything about this one way or the other. He doesn't know any more about it than I do. I'm no expert on fluoride. All I can tell you is what I read in the papers. So this old, what the hell is his name now? Guy that died with Wiley Post. I'll think of his name here in a minute. Anyway, the moral of the story is that this is a deep, dark, nasty secret, and it's going to go just like Hodge. It'll go to the grave and never be revealed. The income tax is another one of those kind of stories. And the ratification of the income tax and how that ruse was pulled off. And everybody believes, you know, that the income tax was properly ratified. It wasn't. It didn't have three-fourths of the states in the ratification process. And the Supreme Court knew that, and they refused to hear the case and said it was a political question. And when you pick up some of these cases and you look and say, oh my God, the Supreme Court knows that. Yeah, there's a lot that, you know, is out there in the public sphere that people know, but they don't talk about it. They're not talking. And this fluoride thing over here, the thing that makes this book so fascinating is that it's called The Fluoride Deception, written by a fellow named Bryson, Christopher Bryson. Bryson, about 375 pages, and went back to the Manhattan Project. Now see, you wouldn't have fluoride in your water without the atomic bomb. If that atomic bomb had not been on the table, if that had not been in the works, there wouldn't have been any need for the fluoride. The idea of putting fluoride into your drinking water would have never come up any more than putting strychnine or arsenic in your drinking water would have come up. Now, if they had needed arsenic to do the same work that fluoride did, you'd have arsenic in your drinking water. If they'd have needed strychnine, they would have sold strychnine and put strychnine in your drinking water. This fluoride was more toxic than the arsenic and the strychnine combined, and they knew that. And they had to sell this to the American public. And what better way to do it than to tell you, hey, this is a health, this is a health elixir. I mean, that's almost like saying, you know, plutonium is a health elixir. You should take at least a little bit of plutonium every day, you know, with your breakfast. See, when I mentioned this the other day to you, if I mentioned the word plutonium, see, right away, you know, nuclear meltdown and the China syndrome comes to your mind. If I say arsenic, oh my God, skull and crossbones, terrible, terrible poison. Fluoride, right away you think of Crest toothpaste. It's a health stuff. You know, it's like Listerine. It's something that you wash your mouth out with. So you don't have a negative opinion about fluoride. It's a positive opinion. That positive opinion comes from advertising, comes from selling it. They've sold this deadly toxic poison as something that's really good for you. So these military pilots are flying in this exotic new compound directly from the bomb factory, straight to Hodge to experiment with. Well, the summer of 43, as Hodge stood at his office window, he confronted a terrible dilemma. Speed was essential in beating the Germans. This is the thing that they were all thinking about. We've got to beat the Germans. And so, you know, from their perspective in 1943, you can understand the urgency. But it wasn't any urgency after the war was over. But they went out and they sold Teflon. They went out and they sold this fluoride. They put it in the people's drinking water. There had to be something that was in their minds after the war, because there wasn't any need to poison the people of America from that point on. There might have been a logical reason for putting it in the water supply in New York. Maybe it was Rochester, New York, you know, to test it, to see what the results were going to be. But, you know, after the war was over, that urgency was gone, wasn't it? But they went ahead anyway. Well, Leslie Groves, General Leslie Groves, understood the dangers of this pell-mell production. He feared the personal injury lawsuits. That's exactly where it's at, boys and girls. And that's the motivator today, the personal injury lawsuits. So the Army moved quickly to protect itself, and its first weapon was secrecy. First weapon, secrecy. Scientists soon delivered courtroom ammunition. Much of the data already collected is proving valuable from a medical legal point of view, noted a February 1946 memo to General Groves' deputy, Brigadier General K.C. Nichols. It is anticipated that further research will also serve in this manner. Well, Colonel Warren had chosen his top fluoride expert carefully, the son of an Illinois school teacher. Harold Hodge was a biochemist whose specialty was the study of bones and teeth. He had arrived at the University of Rochester in 1931, where he was one of an elite cadre of men selected by the Rockefeller Foundation as dental research fellows. The Rockefeller Foundation was the funding basic, or was then funding basic research at selected dental schools in a bid to lift the standards of dental care in the United States. Hodge was also a pharmacologist and toxicologist who by 1937 had forged close links with corporate America. And by the summer of 1943, some of those corporations and institutions were taking a leading role in developing America's first nuclear weapon. Eastman Kodak, a Rochester company, where Hodge had investigated chemical poisoning before the war, was now a leading industrial contractor at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Rockefeller interests were also using fluoride to refine uranium at an undisclosed site in New Jersey and funding their own biomedical research at the University of Rochester. Harold Hodge's role as a gatekeeper at the wartime crossroads of law and medical science was spelled out in a 1944 letter introducing the Rochester scientist to the DuPont Company. The letter, stamped confidential, again lays out a fundamental scientific bias in the Manhattan District's medical program. It was a bias against workers and communities and in favor of corporate legal interests. So the medical section has been charged with the responsibility of obtaining toxicological data, which will ensure the district's being in a favorable position in case litigation develops from exposure to the materials. And Colonel Stafford Warren told John Fulger of DuPont's Haskell Laboratory in a letter dated August 12, 1944. Harold Hodge was to ensure that information about the toxicity of certain fluoride compounds was coordinated between the government and its contractors. And Warren explained, it would be desirable, he told Folger, to have the work on the toxicity of the fluorocarbons being done in your laboratory parallel the investigations being made on similar compounds elsewhere. And for that reason, it would be appreciated if Dr. Harold Hodge of the University of Rochester could visit your laboratory in the near future and exchange in an exchange of ideas and have it affected. All right, now take a look at this now. Notice that their number one concern is the litigation that can come out of this fluoride toxicity. And who's funding it and who wants to be protected? It's corporate America, which makes all the sense in the world. And it tells you why the FDA to this day is in the back pocket of the pharmaceutical industry. And why guys like Dick Armey, for instance, who in about 2001 put a rider on a bill exempting the pharmacological industry, the pharmaceutical industry, from lawsuits. You cannot sue Pfizer or Merck now if a vaccine that is used on you or your child causes damage or injury or death. Can't sue them. They're exempted. So Congress, the government agencies working with big business are working together to limit your claims. That's why you soldiers, when you come back from the war, like the first Gulf War, and you've got Gulf War syndrome, what's the government's first reaction? Deny it and shut up. Deny it and shut up. You'll never collect anything off of it. The truth of the matter is, about 400,000 or 500,000 people participated in that war. And 100,000, maybe as many as 200,000 have been injured by the war. Not from enemy action. Not from enemy action. And they were injured from the toxins that came out of the aspartame that was fed to them in the soda pop that was trucked over there by the truckload. What they're really suffering from, you veterans now that have this Gulf War syndrome, what you're really suffering from is aspartame poisoning. And what you need to do is to detoxify. Detoxify. There's a solution to your problem, and it's activated charcoal. Nobody's telling you what the problem is. Nobody's telling you what the solution is. And nobody is going to pay for it. Because, see, if the government ever said, oh, my God, we gave you aspartame poisoning, why, my God, it would bankrupt the nation. It would bankrupt the nation. We can't have that. It would be a hit to our economy that nobody can sustain. So you have to deny it and then shut up about it. Now, for the few of you out there that say, well, yeah, okay, but I've got this disease, I've got these symptoms, and I'm being tormented by it, and I need to solve my problem. It's activated charcoal. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools in all. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. And it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the webpage as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. If you'd like to order one, just call the law school and ask for it. The number to call, 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors and publications that we endorse and recommend will reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network, or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book, The Fluoride Deception, by Christopher Bryson. It's a whodunit, written in a style, a very unique style. I think it's a historical documentary written in a novel form. I mean, it reads like a novel. And it's got characters, and he lists all the characters, all the whodunits, and it goes back to the Manhattan Project, which is where this story begins. And the story begins here with the Manhattan Project. That's the manufacture, the development of the atomic bomb. So I'm not here throwing rocks at anybody. I'm not casting blame or saying that, you know, the government's all at fault here. At least not in the development of the atomic bomb and so on. But after the war, there wasn't any need to put this stuff into the drinking water. So the reason for doing that, though, was to make fluoride such an innocuous, harmless product that you couldn't sue for damages. I mean, can you imagine suing Bristol Myers or Squibb or somebody, you know, for some cold medicine, you know, something like NyQuil or aspirin, like Bayer aspirin? I'm going to sue the Anacin people or Tylenol people, you know. No, see, everybody accepts Tylenol, aspirin, NyQuil, fluoride. It's accepted by everybody. Milk. I mean, you're going to sue Mid-America Dairies for killing you with milk? Yeah, milk is a toxic poison. Milk. You know, the stuff you buy in the store? Milk, the stuff that comes out of cows. It's a toxic poison. Not as bad as fluoride, but it's toxic nonetheless. And so what we have to do is we have to make this stuff look like it's harmless. And that's the reason for putting it into the drinking water. I mean, what could be more harmless than an additive that you put into the drinking water that's drunk by millions of people every day? Now, that's the motivation behind it, and that's to eliminate the lawsuits. Does it work? I ask you, when was the last time you saw a successful lawsuit for fluoride poisoning? There aren't any. It's worked perfectly. It's genius. And the genius behind this over here was General Leslie Groves. I mean, the guy is an absolute genius. Now, you heard about General MacArthur. You heard about General Eisenhower. You heard about General Patton. You never heard the name General Leslie Groves. He's smarter than all those generals combined. This guy produced the atomic bomb. And he used a toxic substance and put it in your drinking water and got you to accept it. Kills tens of thousands of people. Well, you know, I'm just guessing. We don't know how many people it killed. And that's the beauty of it. There isn't anybody that can tell you how many people it's killing, let alone who is it killing. It's the perfect crime that makes crime and detective stories pale by comparison. Now, you can make estimates, you know, and of course, you know, estimates, they don't carry any weight in court. They just, you know, you can come in here in court and you can sit here and argue and bark at the moon till hell freezes over and you're not going anywhere. Now, remember, the reason for doing this was to protect the government from lawsuits. It's perfect. It has worked. And it's still working to this day. How long can it continue? I don't know. You know, these people keep chipping away, you know, the fluoride deception. There's probably 50 books. If you plugged in fluoride into a Google search, I mean, my God, you'd have so many books and articles and topics on fluoride, like vaccination. Vaccination is another one. You know, what could be more harmless than a polio shot? I mean, that stuff is deadly toxin. I mean, it's poison. It kills people. It kills thousands of people. It kills so many people that the pharmaceutical industry thought it was necessary to be exempted from the lawsuits. The nuclear industry is exempted from lawsuits. You can't sue. If you're killed in a nuclear meltdown at Three Mile Island, you can forget about suing because you're not going anywhere. It's barred by law. You take a vaccine and it kills you, you can forget about suing, kid. You ain't going anywhere. Fluoride, you can forget it. You ain't going anywhere. So in these highly toxic, dangerous substances like milk, vaccines, nuclear accidents, fluoride, they're barred. You're dead. Can't sue, can't collect any damages. And that was the purpose behind it. Now, it's not true with aspartame. I mean, you could still get damages for aspartame. If you could draw a connecting link with fluoride, you could probably sue and you might be successful. But understand this. The genius behind this was Leslie Groves, and he hired a guy by the name of Harold Hodge. Harold Hodge carried this secret to his grave. Now, Harold Hodge's diligence in defending the war industry can be seen in a 1946 court challenge from farmers living near a DuPont fluoride plant in New Jersey. Although not mentioned in any history of the Manhattan Project, the lawsuits were regarded by the military as the most serious legal threat to the U.S. nuclear program, requiring the direct intervention of General Leslie Groves. A closing chapter in the Manhattan Project, the aggressive use of secrecy, science, and public relations by Groves and Hodge, and at least a half dozen federal agencies battling the farmers, is an opening scene in the story of how fluoride was handled by our government following World War II. The gently rolling alluvial soil along the shore of the Delaware estuary in southern New Jersey is some of the most beautiful farmland in the United States. Its historic harvest of fruit and vegetables won New Jersey the accolade of being the Garden State. The orchards downwind of the DuPont plant in Gloucester and Salem counties were especially famous for their high-quality produce. Their peaches went directly to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. Campbell's Soup bought up their tomatoes. But in the summer of 1943, the farmers began to report that their orchards were blighted and that something is burning up the peach crops around here. Poultry died after an all-night thunderstorm, they reported. Fields were sometimes strewn with dead cattle. Residents recalled that while workers who ate the produce that they had picked vomited all night and into the next day. I remember our horses looked sick and were too stiff to work. Mildred Giordano, who was a teenager at the time, told reporter Joel Griffiths, some cows were so crippled that they could not stand up. They grazed by crawling on their bellies. The injuries were confirmed in taped interviews shortly before he died with the chemical consultant Philip Sadler of Sadler Laboratories in Philadelphia on behalf of the farmers' crusading attorney, Counselor William C. Gottschalk of Camden, New Jersey. Sadler had measured blood fluoride levels in laborers as high as 31 parts per million. Blood fluoride is normally well below 1 part per million. These levels are potentially lethal doses. All right, now pause here and let me show you something. Did you hear the story here about the cows and the horses and the people? All right. Remember I said these people do not die from fluoride poisoning. These people die, all right. They die horrible long-term deaths, just like these cows. You know, a cow is reduced to crawling around on the ground to graze because she can't stand up. That cow is going to die. What caused that cow's problem? Why is that cow doing that? When that cow dies, nobody's going to say, you know, fluoride poisoning. No, the cow is going to die from something else, and that's what's going down in the records. And that's what's going into all these people who are dying. You know, about 2.5 million people in America die every year. Then they get a death certificate, and these death certificates list the cause of death. And there's 450 symptoms that you get from the physician's desk reference. And they'll put some one of those symptoms down. It may be Alzheimer's disease. It may be this, that, or something else. They'll put something down on there. But they'll never put down what the cause was. Because the truth of the matter is, we can't blame everything on fluoride. Hell, it could be the milk. It could be a combination of milk, fluoride, spraying, you know, from chemtrails, and smoking cigarettes, and 15 other things that you're doing, including chemicals that may be coming out of your bathroom. And there's 89,000 of these chemicals that are now out here in general use. Now, they tell us that we live better chemically. Well, maybe that's true. Maybe our lives are enriched by these chemicals. I'm not telling you that they don't, but the chemicals have a side effect. They kill you. Over time, they kill you. And, of course, if you're dying slowly, and you die at age 47, and you die slowly for 10 or 15 years, you'll never put two and two together and say, oh, my God, it was the chemicals that did it to me. And it's because the doctor will say, well, you got Lou Gehrig's disease. And you'll say, oh, I was walking down the street, and I opened my mouth, and I breathed in a Lou Gehrig's disease something, and that's why I've got Lou Gehrig's disease. No, that wasn't it at all. That Lou Gehrig's disease is a neurological disease. And many of the symptoms that you get from aspartame, neurological. And we can identify the neurological symptoms, and we can do it in fairly short order, time after time. But you can never connect it directly to the aspartame and take it into court. You can never connect it directly to the fluoride and take it into court. And that's because of the marvelous job that these guys have done in obfuscating the issue. Now, you've got a lot of good guys around here, like this Bryson now. He's trying to tell you. He's got the documents. He went back, you know, 50 years as these documents are being released, and we've got the confessions. And that's the bright spot. The bright spot here is that we actually have the confessions. We can actually connect the dots. And this is the book that connects those dots. I doubt seriously that you're going to be able to ever mount a legal case that's going to hold water. I just, I'm sitting here, you know, I'm an old-time HE lawyer, and I can sit here and say, by God, I don't think you're going to be able to connect those dots and take it into a federal judge and say, listen, we got cause and effect. Here's the smoking gun. We can prove this. You can prove it's toxic. You can prove it kills people. You can prove it killed people in the past, and it's probably killing people today, and it's going to kill people in the future. But you can't identify who it's killing. That's the problem they had with tobacco. Now, the tobacco went down, and it may be that milk will go down, at least homogenized, pasteurized milk. It may be that vaccines will go down. It may be that fluoride will go down. But if it does, it's going to be like tobacco. It'll be 40 years in litigation. You'll have cases and cases and cases that you'll try, but you'll fail. until finally somebody, you know, is able to connect those dots and put it together. But meanwhile, back on the farm, you and I are going to be long dead and buried and pushing up daisies, and I'm sitting there saying, we need a solution. You know, you and I, you know, if you're listening to me right now, you need a solution to fluoride today, not 20 or 30 or 40 years down the line. You need to solve that fluoride problem now. You need to solve that milk problem now. You need to solve that chemtrail problem now. In 2008, not out here in La La Land, you know, 50 years down the line. All right, going on, he says, now these farm workers were pretty weak, Sadler noted, and the New Jersey farmers organized a fluorine committee. They patriotically waited until the war was over. Then they sued DuPont and the Manhattan Project for the fluoride damage. 13 claimants asked for a total of $430,000 in compensation. Little wonder the farmers reported health problems. Conditions on the other side of the DuPont fence were extraordinarily dangerous. More than 1,000 women and men were employed at Manhattan Project contracts at the chamber works during the war, secretly manufacturing elemental fluorine, uranium, hexafluoride, and several exotic new fluorocarbons. Chemical exposures were frequent, making the DuPont employees perhaps the most endangered and fearful of the wartime fluoride workers. By the end of January of 44, at least two DuPont workers had been killed and several scientists injured. Work conditions at the secret fluoride-producing east and blue areas of the chamber works were especially dreadful, with gross violations of safety, inspectors noted. One unit was especially notorious, the government reported. The plant frequently caught on fire, and the activators often burned out, so the employees were frequently exposed to rather large amounts of fluorine compounds. Captain Mears of the Manhattan Project noted in October of 45, medical hazards were attributed to fluorine in a gaseous state, silver fluorides in a powdered state, and liquid 2144, code for fluorocarbon. Injured workers paraded into the DuPont hospital. Doctors often reported a fibrotic condition of both lungs on x-rays. Serious chemical burns were seen very frequently. The mounting injury toll was blamed on fluoride. So in February of 45, doctors at the east and blue areas reported 79 subpar or so-called chronic cases. 16 of those workers had their condition detected in the last 2 months. A Manhattan Project medical investigator, Captain Richard C. Bernstein, warned his boss, Colonel Warren, that workers now feared assignment to the DuPont fluoride processing areas as an exile to Devil's Island. Another report warned of brewing labor unrest. Fear of the physical consequences was becoming prevalent in the areas, so wrote Manhattan Project investigator First Lieutenant Burchard M. Brundage in February of 45. And this fear was being used by certain agitators to cause trouble in the personnel, he added. Now, the farmers' lawsuits electrified the Manhattan Project. There had been no disclosure of the diabolical work conditions at DuPont. Now a public lawsuit pointed a finger directly at the chamber works and fluoride. Now a once-secret November 1945 memo measures the government's concern. The most serious claim to neighboring properties of any operations of the Manhattan Engineering District is the litigation known as the Peach Crop Crisis. These are cases claiming damages to the fruit crop and to the peach trees themselves in and around the operation of the chambers works of the DuPont Company at Kearney, New Jersey. This damage is allegedly caused by the release into the atmosphere, both unintentional and necessary, as a result of the process of hydrogen fluoride. The claims against the district approximate $430,000. Part of the loss would be due to the private contractor and part of the operation of the contractor on behalf of the district. So the military sprang into action, and Dr. Hodge was dispatched to New Jersey to marshal the medical response to the farmers' rebellion. And although DuPont smokestack fluoride had long been spilled into the environment, and a great volume of new fluoride compounds were being made inside the wartime plant, he quickly reported back to Colonel Stafford Warren at Oak Ridge that the mottled teeth seen in the school near the DuPont plant could be attributed to natural fluoride in the groundwater. Such natural fluoride in the water supply meant that the dental markings could not be used as unequivocal proof of industrial poisoning. The situation was complicated by the existence of mottled enamel as a result of fluoride in the drinking water, Hodge told Warren. So Dr. Hodge had an idea for calming the citizens' panic. His prescription gives an early meaning to the term spin doctor and provides a clue that the promotion by the U.S. government of a role for fluoride in tooth health was a powerful national security appeal. And would there be any use in making attempts to counteract the local fear of fluoride on the part of the residents of Salem and Gloucester counties through lectures on F toxicology and perhaps the usefulness of F in tooth decay? Now remember that F isn't the F word, it's fluoride. So Hodge inquired of Colonel Warren. Such lectures, of course, were indeed given, not only to New Jersey citizens and residents, but to the rest of the nation throughout the Cold War. Ah, you're starting to get the picture now? Because of the damage that was caused by DuPont, what we have to do is deny it, number one, which is pretty damn hard to do because there's the peach trees, there's the horses, there's the cows, there's the dead animals out there, there are the sick people over there. That's pretty tough to do. Now, we can clean up the smokestacks, which they did. They went out, they cleaned up the smokestacks. They stopped dropping all of this fluoride on these farmers out here. So that destroyed their case. Once you stop polluting them. But now you've got this damage. Now here's what we call case precedent. If these farmers win this case, my God, it'll open the floodgates. You have to shut it off. This is why the tobacco industry fought those cases on tobacco tooth and nail for 40 years. Nobody ever won a case against a tobacco company until, you know, recent years. Then finally, one case came down and they won it. The tobacco industry would appeal that up. They would take it clear to the U.S. Supreme Court. And they always won until finally something happened and they lost their case. And which creates precedent. That's what happens in asbestos. What you have to do is you have to deny it and stonewall it. That's what Nixon said, remember? Stonewall it. It's a legal term. Number one, shut up. Number two, deny it. Shut up, deny it. Shut up, deny it. See, the average guy, he sits there and he says, well, when wrong is done, you should own up to it and admit it. Well, of course, if you were moral, you would own up to it and admit it. These people aren't moral. They're immoral. They're amoral at best. They're liars. They're frauds, they're charlatans, they're killers, they're psychopathic, and they're in positions of power. That's the scary part. One of them occupies the White House. Hey, I'm running out of time again. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder. We'll take this up next time, same time, same station, but you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our webpage. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Air time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.